lesson 228 triumph, and then you can load the notes that we're going to be using here in class and follow along. If you're watching right now on YouTube, you can just go straight in the description underneath the video and find those notes there as well. So, lesson 228, triumph, the final acclamation of the AV, final acceptance and literary acclaim. I want to get right into the introduction today because we've got a lot of ground that I want to try to cover as always, okay? Introduction. In lesson 227, that would have been last week, we began using chapter 12 of Alistair McGrath's book, In the Beginning, the story of the King James Bible and how it changed a nation, a language, and a culture, to frame a discussion of the final acclamation of the AV. In doing so, we identify 3 points for consideration. Number one, the Battle of the Bibles, Charles I and the War Against the Geneva Bible. Ambivalence, the period of the Puritan Commonwealth, and Restoration, the final acceptance of the King James Bible. So I did bring in my copy of Alistair McGrath just to kind of show people what it is. It's a very good book. There is some information in it that I think is a little bit dated since it's over 20 years old now. But on the whole, it's an excellent book as far as history goes and the specific sort of angle that he takes in writing it. And so we've been extracting these points from the book. All right. Now, only point three, so that would be restoration, the final acceptance of the King James, only point three remains undiscussed from the previous lesson. Before moving on, I would like to briefly follow up on a couple of points made by McGrath in point two regarding the printed history of the Geneva Bible. Okay, now, according to A.S. Herbert's Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1526, and that should say to 1961, that's a typo there that needs to be corrected, okay? This is Herbert's catalog right here, okay? It's a pretty thick book, and it is what it says. It is a catalog of printings by year, by publisher, and by contents of what is in each one of these. And this catalog starts from 1526 and runs all the way to 1961. There are other catalogs that exist that just look at American printings. I have one at home that just looks at American printings. But a book like that is really important to see some of the details that are being talked about by somebody like McGrath. So according to A.S. Herbert's Historical Catalog of Printed Editions of the English Bible, 1525 to 1961, there is one edition of the Geneva Bible published in London by Norton and Bill in 1619. Okay? The catalog lists Geneva editions published in Amsterdam in the following years, 1633, 1640, 1644. Also of interest is the 1643 Soldier's Pocket Bible, printed in London by G.B. and R.W. for G.C. G.C. is General Cromwell. Okay, it's Oliver Cromwell. So, regarding this unique edition, Herbert states the following quote, a selection of short passages, nearly all from the Geneva version, printed in pamphlet form for the use of the parliamentary soldier in the Civil War. So here's an actual copy of this. This is on archive.org. Here's an actual copy of the Soldier's Pocket Bible from 1643. Okay? And you can, I have a link to this in the digital copy of these notes. But you can read this online by just clicking through and navigating through the Soldier's Pocket Bible. So this is a collection of passages that are just presented to the reader, and this was designed to be something that a soldier could carry along with them in their pocket without being overladen by carrying a big Bible. And this was developed and published by Cromwell for his parliamentary army during the Civil War. And most of the Bible passages that appear in the pocket Bible are taken from the Geneva Bible. Okay? Go back to the notes. A tradition has always existed that Cromwell's troops were supplied with pocket Bibles, and some have confidently asserted that a very small complete Bible like that of a 24 printed by Field in 1653 served this purpose. The discovery of the real soldier's pocket Bible was due to George Livermore of Massachusetts, who described his own copy in 1854. A second copy was later found by George Thompson in the British Museum, having August 3rd, apparently the day of its publication, written alongside the date of the title page. So you can see from this pocket Bible that the cover tells you when it was published, 1643. So this is a sort of, an edition that had been sort of legendary and believed to have existed, but then some people actually found copies of it to prove that it actually did exist and did contain mostly Geneva readings. Okay? So this publication data demonstrates the point made by McGrath in Lesson 227, namely that the fortunes of the English Bible were greatly impacted by politics. Also of note, published in Amsterdam, are 7 printings of the King James Bible with Geneva marginal notes between 1642 and 1715. Herbert states the following in his catalog regarding the first edition from 1642, quote, "The Holy Bible, with most profitable annotations, which notes have never before been set forth with this new translation." So the new translation there is a reference to the King James Bible, okay? "But are now placed in due order with great care and industry. King James Version, with the notes of the Geneva Bible and Junius's annotations on Revelation." Now I have here, this is a copy. This is the best I could do. I scour the internet trying to find a digital copy of this, and this is the best I could find. This is the title page. So what we just read from was the title page. "The Holy Bible contained the Old and New Testaments, newly translated out of the original tongues and with the former translations, diligently compared and revised by His Majesty's special command." But now here's the part you want to pay attention to, 2 parts. "With most profitable annotations upon all the hard places and other things of great importance, which notes have never before been set forth with the new translation." So this is a King James Bible with Geneva Bible what?
Notes.
Okay? "Now placed in due over something with great care." And then you can see the insignia of the printer here that this is published where?
Amsterdam.
So this is not published in Britain. This is published in Amsterdam. So if you look underneath the picture, unfortunately, I was hoping that I could actually see the text. So in other words, you could see the King James Bible then with the Geneva notes in the margin, but all of the images I was able to find did not show that. So if you're watching this and you have access to that or know how to find it, I would love to see it. Anyway, according to Herbert, this edition, so that would be this one right here on the screen, depicted in the notes, this edition was published in the following years, 1642, 1643, 1649, that should say 1672, not 1972, 1679, 1708, and 1715. Okay? These Amsterdam editions speak to both the general acceptability of the authorized version as a translation and the enduring popularity of the Geneva Marginalia as a study tool. So throughout the rest of this lesson, we will conclude our discussion of the final acclamation of the authorized version by considering the following points. First, we're going to look at that third outstanding point from last week in Lesson 227, which is restoration, the final acceptance of the King James Bible. And then, time permitting, we're going to look at, second, literary acclaim, the King James Bible as literature. Okay? So let's look at this first point. Before we do, does anybody have any questions or comments? No, this is the English Civil War in the 1640s and 1650s.
Okay,
not the Revolution or the American Civil War.
Okay, that's right.
Yep. Okay, so any other questions? Okay, triumph, the final acclamation of the AV. What follows is the third and final section of chapter 12 from Alistair McGrath's book, In the Beginning, the story of the King James Bible and how it changed a nation, a language, and a culture that we will be following. So, it's actually probably, it's not the last, let me just check something here. I actually don't think it's the last section. So we might need to amend that because I think the last section is, about the KJV in America. So I'm going to have to change that. So, restoration, the final acceptance of the King James. So in the following section, McGrath chronicles the final triumph of the King James Bible in English political and religious life. He says, quote, "The restoration of Charles II in 1616 put an end to any talk about revising the King James translation or replacing it with any rival. Charles's concern was to restore the Church of England to its proper place in English society and to regain the stability that had been painfully lacking in recent years." So that would be during the years of the war. Okay? "The publication of the Book of Common Prayer in 1662 alongside the King James translation of the Bible was designed to ensure religious conformity and security so that the problems of the past might be left behind. The King James Bible was now seen as a pillar of restoration for society, holding together church, state, the bishops and the monarch at a time when social cohesion was essential to England's future as a nation." So in other words, have they just gone through a major political upheaval in the English Civil War, and are they wanting to have cultural, political, and religious stability in this period immediately following the restoration of the monarchy? So the King James Bible is going to play a role in providing that political, social, and religious stability. "The Act of Uniformity, 1662, which brought into being a new Book of Common Prayer, firmly upheld the establishment of the Church of England. Nobody wanted to return to the chaos of the Puritan Commonwealth. This was bad news for the Geneva Bible, which was now viewed as a seditious text, given theological support to a politically and religiously discredited section of English society." So remember, we saw that it was the Puritans and the Commonwealth that favored the Geneva Bible, but now that the monarchy has been restored and the issue has been settled, now to read the Geneva Bible was viewed sort of as a seditious act politically, hearkening back to a time period of instability and chaos. To possess the Geneva Bible could spell instant social death. So nobody's being executed, it just means you would be socially viewed as, you know,
like shunned,
or, you know, you're inept, you're not really up on the times, that sort of stuff, okay? It had become a potent symbol of a period in English history that was both feared and despised by leaders of the political culture of the Restoration. With the restoration of the monarchy, to popular acclaim, the Battle of the Bibles had ended. The King James Bible had finally triumphed over its rival. The grounds of that triumph may partly rest in its eloquence or its excellence in the excellence of its translation. Yet the most significant factor in its triumph appears to have been the fact that it was associated with the authority of the monarch at a time when such authority was viewed positively. In marked contrast, the Geneva Bible was marginalized not on account of the quality of its translation or English prose, but because it had been the preferred translation of the detested Puritan faction, who had now been comprehensively routed militarily and politically. The new translation, as the King James Bible was still termed even late in the 17th century, was still regarded with some misgivings at the opening of the 18th. Yet, it was during this century that a decisive change in attitude toward the new translation developed. It was virtually impossible to point to any defining moment or event that crystallized the perception that this was indeed a great work of religious literature, but at some point during this century, perhaps around 1750, such a perception settled over the work and would remain in place until the end of the First World War. If the first 150 years of its history were encumbered with hints of discontent, criticism, and suspicion, its next 150 years were characterized by something at times approaching uncritical adulation. When, why, and how did this take place? It is impossible to say. Perhaps an increasing distance from the originals of the translation began to allow the work to be endowed with the characteristics of a classic. Perhaps familiarity dulled the sense to the weakness of the translation or allowed well-known words to become embedded in the memory. Whatever the reasons, and these remain less than fully understood, there is no doubt that a... That seems like a typo.
Yeah, we couldn't figure it out.
Let me see if I can figure it out. That's why I decided to bring the book with me. Let me see here. Decisive. The word is decisive. So we'll start that over, that sentence over again. Whatever the reasons, and these remain less than fully understood, there is no doubt that a decisive and irreversible change came about in the esteem in which the King James Bible was held in England and beyond. Okay, so let's just stop there. So, let me just be honest, like, so McGrath is saying some things here that that the average King James onlyist is probably not necessarily going to like, but I think he's speaking here as a historian, and I think he's presenting largely accurate history as far as how the King James Bible was perceived and treated and dealt with in its first 150 years versus the second 150 years. Okay? So, Professor David Norton concurs with McGrath when he states in his 2011 book, The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndal to Today, that by 1729, the King James Bible was, quote, absolutely established as the Bible in the English-speaking world. So, when people, after the early, let's just say 1730, when people talked about the Bible in the English-speaking world, what were they talking about? They were talking about the King James Bible. Okay? So anybody got any comments or questions before we move on to the next point? Now, is that still true today?
No.
People today talk about the Bible. Is there a universally understood concept of what the Bible is today in the 21st century American church?
No.
I'm going to say no. Okay?
They're all using
different stuff, and they don't say the same thing, and they're sometimes contradictory of each other, and there's no... Last summer, we read from Leland Rankin's book, The Language of the King James Bible, where he bemoaned the loss in the English-speaking world of a common understanding of what the Bible was, and how we've lost so many things since people no longer have this common understanding. So, it takes a while for the King James to assert itself as the Bible, but once it does, it basically is viewed as the Bible in the English-speaking world for the next 150, 200 years, okay? And even in the United States, frankly, up through, I would argue, World War II, the modern versions did not start to really gain any ground until after World War II. I've talked about that in other places, but I believe that's an accurate statement. After World War II, Billy Graham and the neo-evangelical movement takes off in the United States, and they start promoting other modern versions. And then that creates what I would argue is the modern King James only movement as a reaction against that view. Okay? Talked about that in other places. There's a video on the church's YouTube channel called A Brief History of the King James Only Movement where I talk about some of those issues. Okay? So, does anybody have any questions or comments before we move on? No? Okay. So I want to look at this now from a little bit different lens. And this is through the lens of the King James Bible as a piece of literature. So far when we looked at McGrath, we're looking at it sort of as a piece of religious and political significance. But there's also a debate and a discussion that is happening concurrent with that regarding the literary qualities of the King James Bible. Okay? So let's look at this. Written for a popular audience, McGrath's work is light when... So that's this book, McGrath. Okay, this is written for a popular audience. All right. McGrath's work is light when compared to David Norton's monumental work and history of the English Bible as literature. That's this book right here. This book is 475 pages. This is a massive work chronicling the history of the King James Bible, the English Bible, as literature. All right, I've read the whole thing. It's fascinating reading, but it's way more depth than what we need to go into here. Okay, so look at the notes. Norton's 400-page work plunges the depths of how the King James Bible was perceived as a piece of English literature. Parties interested in a deep dive into the history of how the King James Bible transformed from a perceived literary ugly duckling into the pinnacle written work of the English language are encouraged to read Norton's book. In 2011, In commemoration of the 400th anniversary of the King James Bible, Norton wrote a smaller book, referenced above. The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today. That's this book right here. Okay? Now, you tell me, which one of those is probably going to give us more what we need for this class? The 475-page one or the shorter popular work? Okay? So this book here from 2011 summarizes and condenses a lot of the stuff that he says in this book into a much shorter, more popular treatment. So we're going to follow that book here in what we look at. Okay? Beginning with Hugh Brougham's early criticisms, Norton uses Chapter 7, titled Reputation and Future, to summarize key stages in the reception experienced by the AV in terms of literary perception. According to Norton, since the time of Brougham, quote, the earliest reported comment on its language comes from a man famous for his knowledge of Hebrew and translations, John Selden. After averring, that the King James Bible, together with the Bishop's Bible, is the best translation in the world and renders the sense of the original the best, he turns to its style. Okay? Now understand, can you have a translation that is accurate, but stylistically does not read well?
Yes.
Okay, you can do that. So you have to understand this in this conversation. There's going to be discrepancies that you have to make between translational accuracy versus literary style and how the thing reads as a piece of English literature. Okay, so look at what he says here. There is no book so translated as the Bible for the purpose. Now this is an interesting thing. He says, this is Selden now, if I translate a French book into English, I turn it into English phrase and not into French English. Okay? And then he gives this French phrase, ill, fate, fraud. My French is not good, so you'll excuse me if I said it wrong, okay? I say 'tis cold, not it makes cold. So he's talking, so when you translate into French into English, you're stating in English what it says where? In French. Right? That's the whole point of making a translation. You guys following this? Okay? Then he says, but the Bible is rather translated into English words than into English phrase. So in other words, when you translate the Bible, you're stating the Bible in the English. Your primary goal is not to write English. Your primary goal is to translate the Bible out of Hebrew and Greek into what? English. Okay? So then he says the Hebraism, I think that should be Hebraisms, are kept, and the phrase of the language is kept. For example, he uncovered her shame, which is well enough so long as scholars have to do with it, but when it comes among the common people, Lord, what gear mockery do they make of it? So this is an important comment, but it's also a little bit difficult comment to understand. What Selden is talking about is, if you're going to translate accurately, are you sometimes going to make clunky English?
Yeah.
Okay? Because you're not just writing English, you're saying in English what the Bible what? Says. So if there's an inherent ambiguity or clunkiness or difficulty in the original language, is there going to be similarly the same in English? Okay? That's what he's getting at. So look at page 5. Literal translation had used language for the purpose, but the people mocked it for its unnaturalness. This negative view of the King James Bible as English writing prevailed for roughly a century and a half, absolutely at odds with the later admiration for the King James Bible as great, in some eyes, the greatest work of English literature. So understand what Norton is talking about. He's talking about the Bible as a piece of English what?
Literature.
Literature. All right. According to Norton, for the first half century until the Restoration, so that would be 1611 to 1660, scholarship was the primary issue in terms of early criticism of the AV. We saw in Lesson 227, during this time frame, quote, two attempts at revision, possibly connected, were made in the Commonwealth time. So remember that when the Cromwellian situation took hold, did they endeavor to try to revise the King James Bible, even though nothing ever came of it? We talked about that last week in Lesson 227. So look at the quote. In 1652 and 1653, a group of revisers was appointed, led by Baptist Henry Jesse. Chief among his principles of translation was literalness, leading to a version, quote, as exactly our agreeing with the original as we can attain. So what is his primary concern? English readability or literal rendering? Now, so every time you make a translation, are you going to have some element of give and take on that? Okay? Indicative of Jersey's priorities in his preference for the King James Bible's margin, in which above 800 places is righter than the line. So understand, remember we've already talked about the marginal notes, right? Are there places in the marginal notes where they give a more literal Hebrew or Greek reading? Okay? So what Jesse is saying here is in 800 places, he prefers the literalness of the King James Bible margin over what's actually where? In the text. Because he's favoring literalness over what? A certain amount of readability, I guess we'll say in English for lack of a better term. Okay? That is more literal than the text. So he's saying in these 800 places, the margin is more literal than the text. This was his opinion. The work was nearly completed, but for reasons unknown, commissioners were appointed to examine and approve it, and it disappeared without a trace. The King James Bible was admirable but improvable as an accurate translation, yet the failed attempts to improve it led to affirmations of its virtues as a translation. So, what he's saying there is, was there a time period where there were hands on the text that were seeking to try to alter it to a more literal reading?
Yep.
And they were looking at the marginalia of the 1611 to sort of say that. At least this was what Jesse's point was, but nothing ever came of this. The century's last attack on the King James Bible's accuracy was published in 1659 in Robert Gell's An Essay Toward Amendment of the Last English Translation of the Bible, or a proof by any instances that the last translation of the Bible may be improved. Gell, too, was an advocate of literal translation. But the will to revise passed with the Commonwealth, and the view that he wrote against, that the King James Bible is so correct that it needs no essay toward the amendment of it, prevailed for a century. So in other words, once the Cromwellian parliamentary system felt folded, did any attempt to revise the King James Bible for more literalness also go away?
Yep.
That's what he's getting at, okay?
Right.
Yeah.
Is there anywhere that those 800 issues that he had with the scripture, are those published, or is it just him referencing the 800?
I'd have to track back through the footnotes. It could be published somewhere. My guess would be that it is in some collection of this guy's writings in a museum or library in Britain. For example, the British Museum might have a collection of Henry Jesse's writings where he maybe talks about this. I don't know that it was ever published in a formal treatise that was made available to the British public at that time. Okay?
That's his opinion.
Right.
That's his opinion, correct. That's not like a formal opinion of some authorized body to make a judgment like that. Okay? In the next paragraph, Norton discusses how perceptions of the King James Bible changed, beginning with the Restoration in 1660 until the middle of the 18th century. So that'd be the middle of the 1700s. From the Restoration into Augustine times, so what's that? That's a style. Augustine is a style of British literature produced during the reigns of Queen Anne, King George I, and George II in the first half of the 18th century, and ending in the 1740s with the deaths of Alexander Pope and Jonathan Swift. So that's a specific literary period. So if you go to take, I was talking to you about 17th to 18th century British literature this morning, right? If you go and take the class in 18th century British literature, they're going to tell you all about the Augustan period, and that's a specific time period in the literary history of Britain, okay? So that's what he's talking about when he uses that word. So let's read that again without the bracket. From the Restoration into the Augustan times, 1660 to the middle of the 18th century, discussion moved from scholarship to the literary merits of the Bible, and was for much of this time, I think I should say, especially concerned with the originals rather than the King James Bible. He goes then on a long discussion of Milton. I did not put it in there just because it takes too long. While the rhetorical idea of literary excellence dominated, they show how the Bible contained flowers of eloquence. More prosaically, how all... So this is... We were talking about British guys in the board meeting yesterday. Okay. How all the figures of speech could be found excellently used in it. And then as the Longanian ideas of sublimity in literature became the new fashion around the beginning of the 18th century, how the Bible possessed this effective power. So the discussion is going to move now from accuracy of translation into eloquency of English. Okay? Such interests and ideas began to rub off on the King James Bible as the English representative of the admired originals. Some writers simply generalized, some transcribed little bits from the original as example, some paraphrased, but more and more used the King James Bible. Now this is important. So they're talking about eloquent English, and more of them start to use the King James Bible as examples of eloquent what? English. So this is going to change the perception now of the King James Bible. They might not have thought that the King James Bible itself was good English writing, but the effect of seeing literary quality demonstrated through the King James Bible became inescapable. The earliest handbook of rhetoric to use the King James Bible, John Smith's fairly popular The Mystery of Rhetoric Unveiled, 1656, last printed in 1688, shows this effect beginning. Smith demonstrated his Greek-driven figures of speech with Latin, English, and scriptural examples. These late, conducting very much to the right understanding of the sense of the letter of the scriptures. From the sense to the letter of the scriptures from the title. Characteristics in his treatment of synonymania, or synonyms, as the common man would say, of synonyms, a commodious heaping together of diverse words of one signification, that, as he nicely puts it, adorneth and garnisheth speech as a rich wardrobe, wherein many and sundry changes of garments to adorn one and the same person. What is he talking about? He's talking about the fact that the King James Bible use English synonyms all the time, or did it always use the same English word? It did not use the same English word. They intentionally use what? Synonyms. And notice how he's talking about this synonymania as adorning and garnishing the text. So is he speaking of this in positive ways? Yeah. The majority of the examples are scriptural. Now watch, more often than not verbatim from the King James Bible. So the reader begins to learn to appreciate what we would call parallelism throughout this description of synonymy and verse, such as, now watch, he gives an example. The Lord also thundered in the heavens, the highest gave his voice. See, there's a parallelism there, right? The Lord also thundered in the heavens, And that answers to the highest gave his what? So the Lord answers to highest, and thundered in the heavens answers to gave his what? Voice. So there's a parallel structure. It's called a Hebraism, and that's how God inspired it. That is now coming over into the English. So what's happening now is writers who are commenting on the literary quality of the English language are now using examples from the King James Bible to demonstrate this literary quality, which over time begins to change the perception of the King James Bible and people begin to view it as a work of literary excellence. Is everybody following this general flow here? Okay. Amidst the classical figures, Smith includes a section on Hebraism. He finishes with Pathiopia, which designates not a drive but an effect. So looking forward to ideas of the sublime. It is a form of speech whereby the speaker moves the mind of his hearers to some vehemency of affection as love, hatred, gladness, sorrow, etc. He illustrates it only from the Bible, including this striking image. Can a woman forget her sucking child? Yes, they may forget, yet will I not forget thee. Behold, I have graven thee upon the palms of my hands. And that's a quote from Isaiah 49, verses 15 and 16. Thus, he demonstrates and teaches literary, that word's wrong too, appreciation of the King James Bible. So he's teaching literary appreciation, and he's doing it now through the use of what? The King James Bible, to show where the King James Bible has these literary qualities. So this is going to now change the literary perception of the King James Bible. But it took time, look at the next part, but it took time for this kind of awareness to take hold. In short, Augustan England was most propitiousness for the appreciation of the King James Bible as a piece of English writing. Yet the Augustans, while belittling the King James Bible, were beginning to appreciate it. So there's sort of this period where there's like some double talk, where it's not quite yet cool to admit that the King James Bible is good, but yet you're going to kind of acknowledge that there's like good literary qualities to it. Okay? It's kind of like people admitting whether or not they like Trump. Here is the phrase, quote, all the disadvantages of an old prose translation in context, yet how beautiful. So notice, all the disadvantages of an old prose translation. So there he's talking negatively about it, right? But then, in context, yet how beautiful do the holy writings appear under all the disadvantages of an old prose translation. So really, while he's talking somewhat negatively about it, is he also talking positively about it? So there's sort of this double speak going on here in this quote, okay? So beautiful that with a charming and elegant simplicity, they ravish and transport the learned reader, so intelligible that the most unlearned are capable of understanding the greater part of them. So on the whole, is that a pretty positive statement?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's a curious combination of praise and dispraise that was much repeated between 1690 and 1731. All right, so we'll stop there. Anybody have any questions before we look at the next section? So, do we get the idea that the literary understanding is changing now? It's swinging. The pendulum is swinging. In the next paragraph, Norton explains how perception of the King James Bible changed from, quote, genuine appreciation to explicit admiration. All right? The change needed to turn these ideas to some genuine appreciation of the King James Bible into explicit admiration was slow coming. The people got there more quickly than the intelligentsia. Duh. So did the people see the quality of this way before the eggheads in the university did? Okay? From the time of Tyndale onwards, the Bible and literacy went hand in hand. So AJ, this speaks to a point you raised a couple weeks ago, I think. People learned to read in order to read the Bible. In due course, the Bible became the chief book in teaching children to read. The King James Bible, as it became the only Bible in England, assumed a unique place not just in religious consciousness, but in the linguistic and literary consciousness. It was nursery, story, primer, adolescent, and adult reading. So would you read it to a baby or a kid in the nursery? Would you read them Bible stories when they were a child? It was the primer to teach them how to read English, and it was the reader from which adolescents and adults read. Okay? So is it fitting and inserting itself into every category within English society? Okay? It was nursery, story, primer, adolescent, and adult reading present from the alpha to the omega of verbal consciousness. So in other words, from the time you were born until the time you what? Died was the King James Bible in the literary consciousness of English-speaking people. Okay? Its faith, its language, imagery, story, and poetry heard, read, and quoted was the highest common factor in the mental environment of millions over many generations. So did everybody who read the Bible at the time, did they understand and read it through the lenses and the prism of a King James Bible? Okay? Now, you tell me, are we better off today without that common understanding of what the Bible is than we were back then?
No.
I would say absolutely not. We are not better off. Okay? It was part of home and loved, or occasionally reacted against like home. Regardless of the literary standards of the intelligentsia, regardless of what they thought the best standards of writing, such love created a sentimental basis for admiration of the King James Bible, and it made the King James Bible the most familiar standard of English. Jonathan Swift made the point in 1712, responding to the observation that if it were not for the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer in the vulgar tongue, we should hardly be able to understand anything that was written among us 100 years ago, which is certainly true for those books being perpetually read in churches, have proved a kind of standard language, especially for the common people. So in other words, because of the literary forms and features of the King James Bible, were the common people able to go back and read English literature from prior centuries and still understand it? Because the King James Bible kept some of these things current in English society. Okay? So let me ask you a question. If you're sitting in English class in 1830, and the teacher says, all right, it's time to read Shakespeare, are they going to be like, well, you don't understand it? Or did they all understand it because they were reading a King James Bible? So, did reading a King James Bible keep those types of literary qualities current in the English understanding of the language for a long time? Okay? Besides creating that special form of English, religious English, the Bible and the prayer book acted as a conservative force, keeping current, or even over a long period, return to currency, older forms of English and older English words that otherwise probably would have disappeared. Which is true today. You know? Some of the discussion you hear in modern times about, you know, archaic words and modern versions of the King James Bible, there are certain words that are kept current just because they are used and read and understood within a King James Bible. Okay? Words like prevent, let, come to mind. You know, he who now letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. Well, let means to hinder, right? Well, if you play tennis, do you know what the word let means? If you serve and your serve hits the net, it's called a what? A let. In other words, did the net hinder the progress of the ball? So that's a reserve, right? So
somebody thought the word was net.
No, it's let.
Oh,
so I did too when I was a kid until I realized what was going on. So even today, are there certain English words that are kept in current usage because so many people still read the King James Bible? Now, obviously it's not what it once was, but are there still a fair number of English-speaking people that prefer to read the Bible from a King James Bible? And in so doing, are there certain ways of speaking that are still kept in the imagination of people as they read English that otherwise would not have been? Now that's not every word, okay? There's obviously words there that you don't know, like when, W-E-N. Anyone know what when means? It means like a cancer. Okay, you know, so there are words that are in the King James Bible that we just don't use anymore. That's obviously the case, but because it is still read so often, it has kept certain words current longer than they otherwise would have been. Okay.
Wot.
W-O-T. Yeah, that's like I wot not kind of stuff. Yeah, I'd have to look it up. You just need to find the built-in dictionary and find out what that word means. What's that? By the way, I am working on a series of videos that I'm going to be releasing from home on the issue of does the King James Bible have a built-in dictionary? But I don't want to get sidetracked onto that because we could easily take up a long time with that. But anyway, the answer is yes and no. That's the answer. In short, yes and no. Some words are defined, some words what? Aren't. So, what's that? Yeah. Nor discusses a couple 18th century attempts to improve the King James Bible, such as Daniel Mace's Diglot, Greek English New Testament, 1729, Robert Loos' Isaiah from 1778, and Edward Harwood's literal translation of the New Testament from 1769. Most of these were, quote, one edition wonders and were critically reviewed by the English intelligentsia and had no traction on a popular level. Yet the failure of these, that would be those attempts to revise, would be, as the failure to revise these would be King James Bible replacements, bolstered the popular perception of the authorized version. Quote, the general but not universal mediocrity of these versions, so that would be the ones that I just explained in the previous statement, made a strong contribution to the reputation of the King James Bible. The changing tone of the reviewers of these new Bibles tells the story as they swing away from sympathy and encouragement to outright admiration for the King James Bible. Instead of the achievement of a polished Bible being looked forward to, now the King James Bible is looked back to as the literary standard. It is not merely a relic, but a venerable relic that has beneficially influenced the language. Its age is still recognized, but no longer disliked. So it becomes nostalgically viewed as good. And not just good, but exceptional. Okay? Insofar as one can locate this change in reputation of the King James Bible, it belongs to the 1760s. The change in the King James Bible's reputation was part of a more general change in taste, a change that now seemed inevitable. I think I should say seemed inevitable. Seems inevitable. See, we're going to check that. Given the achievement of the pre-Augustan literature and the excess of the later Augustans, the history sketch here shows the King James Bible played a significant role in creating this change. So the King James Bible is not only influencing the way people think, is it causing people to change the way they view literature? Is the point that Norton is getting at. According to Professor Norton, after 1660, it became, quote, the 1760, the dominant opinion regarding the King James Bible. The King James Bible scholarship could and should be improved, but its language could not and should not be tampered with. Moreover, and as admiration became customary, so the trails of the King James Bible and even the persistent criticism of it through the first half of the century were forgotten, and people began to believe the King James Bible's merits were immediately perceived and caused to be an instant success. So now do you start getting the perception that everybody always viewed it this way, and therefore it was automatically an instant success? So do you get a bit of retrospective revision there on early views of the AV, okay?
Aren't you also having 100+ years of past history now where it's almost like you've heard people trying to refute it, and now you're what, like 140 some years?
Yeah.
It's almost like it's going to be venerable just on that alone. It's the testify.
It's similar to a modern King James advocate saying, oh, well, when it first came off the press in 1611, the English-speaking world was like, oh, finally we have God's word in our language. Well, that's not... You might like to think of it that way, but is that the way the people back then thought of it? It's much more complicated than that, right? So it gains steam over time, and then once it becomes the dominant view, people look back and judge the history based upon the dominant view, and therefore they sometimes misread what actually people thought back then. Okay, so it happens all the time with all sorts of things. All right, where are we at though? I lost my spot.
Moreover,
and admiration became customary, so the trails of the King James Bible and even the persistent criticism of it, through the first half of the century were forgotten, and people began to believe that the King James Bible's merits were immediately perceived and caused it to be an instant success. In the words of another advocate of revision, it was a happy consequence of this acknowledged excellence of the King James Bible that all other versions fell immediately into disrepute and no longer known to the generality of the people and are only sought after by the curious. Well, that might be true after 1700, but was that true before 1700 or during the time of the time of the Puritan Commonwealth? That certainly would not have been a true statement. Okay, but notice how he now has the perception that that's what happened based upon how much the King James has grown in popular consciousness and admiration. Okay, all these ideas have proved tenacious, and sometimes the argument that the King James Bible was a literary revision has been powerfully made. So in other words, some have gone so far as to say that the King James Bible was revised as a literary work, not as a doctrinal theological work. Okay. Now, here's where Norton, in my opinion, starts getting into some stuff that I don't particularly appreciate, but we've got to be honest about what he says. In order to capture the reputation of the King James Bible after 1760, Norton coined the following term, aviolatry, or authorized version olatry. In other words, now we're going to worship what? The King James, okay? While I understand Professor Norton's use of the term, I do not particularly care for it. So I understand why he's using it, but I don't like the term. Much of the story of the... top of page 8. We should be able to finish, I think. Much of the story of the King James Bible's reputation after 1760 is taken up with the phrase... sometimes judicious, sometimes taken to rhetorical excess. Along with brandolatry, which I have called AV-olatry, or authorized version olatry, became the norm. And then he quotes a lengthy piece from Father Frederick William Faber. It was way too long to include. The unique place of the King James Bible in the hearts of many over 200 years is well captured. And then he says, a chorus of claims and phrases express faith in the excellence of the King James Bible. Thomas Babington Macaulay proclaimed of it, quote, that stupendous work, and that it was, quote, a book which, if everything else in our language should perish, would alone suffice to show the whole extent of its beauty and power. Now, I kind of like that, because I think that's true. Okay? Among others, Richard Chenevix Trench, I guess, Archbishop, philologist, and one of the makers of the revised version of the American, and the American scholar George P. Marsh thought it, quote, the first English classic. Marsh, adding that it was, quote, the highest exemplar of purity and beauty of language existing in our speech. Now, those are high praise for the AV, right? J.G. Fraser, author of The Golden Bough, recognized how much this had become a cliche, quote, that our English version of the Bible is one of the greatest classics in the language is admitted by all in theory, but few people appear to treat it as such in practice. Others, including three of the makers of the revised version, like the phrase from Spencer's, The Faerie Queen, quote, well of English undefiled. So they're calling the King James a well of English undefiled. Okay. Another favorite with a lengthy history was Lowe's essay titled "The Noblest Monument of English Prose." So what Norton's saying is that eventually, does this situation with respect to the King James become such that it becomes viewed as the pinnacle, the monument, the summit of English writing? Okay. Toward the end of this section, Professor Norton addresses the extent of aviolatry, again, his word, not mine, and addressing the idea that emerged in some quarters that the King James Bible was inspired. In doing so, he quotes books that are popular among modern King James-only advocates, the translators revived by Alexander McClure and the King James Version defended by Edward F. Hills. Quote, "Inevitably, some thought of the King James Bible as inspired. The first biographer of the King James Bible translators, the American evangelist Alexander McClure, held, quote, that the translators enjoyed the highest degree of that special guidance which is ever granted to God's true servants in the exigencies of deep commencement to his kingdom on earth, eventually enlisting the historical position of the King James Bible that Faber described too well. This became the fundamentalist position that Edward F. Hills puts this way, quote, the King James Version is the historical Bible of the English-speaking Protestants. Upon it, God, working providentially, has placed the stamp of his approval through the usage of many generations of Bible-believing Christians. Hence, if we believe in God's providential preservation of the Scriptures, we will return to the King James Version, and in so doing, we will be following the clear leading of the Almighty." Now let me just say, I tend to agree with Hills, but Norton doesn't like what Hills said. Okay? Now I'm not saying the King James Bible is inspired in the same way that Paul was when he wrote Romans. But what I'm saying is, does preservation secure intact the inspiration of the original and thereby grant us access to it throughout history? Okay? To some, like Benjamin Jowett, Regius Professor of Greek at Oxford, reflecting on the Revised Version New Testament, it seemed, quote, that in a certain sense the Authorized Version is more inspired than the original. So, obviously there's a lot of things there that people debate about, but we need to finish this up. Norton concludes this section of chapter 7 by discussing how the fortunes of the King James Bible were reversed after World War II as the translation gradually fell out of favor in much of the English-speaking world. The argument for this was made largely on the back of archaisms of the language. The King James Bible, being once praised for its majesty and eloquence, was deemed archaic and unintelligible. Consequently, the latter half of the 20th century was witness to publication of many different modern versions, all trying to supplant the King James Bible as, quote, as you should put quotes around this, as the Bible of the English-speaking world. So, I think you have there a good summary of the fortunes of the King James. So today, are you going to encounter a lot of people that are going to speak ill of the King James on account of its language, some archaic words, okay, and so forth, and they're going to say, well, therefore it's unintelligible, you need to get a modern version. Okay, I'm not in agreement with those sentiments. I think it is intelligible, and I think using normal reading ability in an English dictionary, you can figure out what it means. I don't think it's the terrible situation that many have painted it to be. All right, so we're right at 10 o'clock. I'm going to close down the equipment and pack this up, and if there's any questions, we'll take them off camera, but we got to move.